Okay, hey everyone, it's Jason Hauerlach here, Essays Editor for First Person Scholar. And today we're going to be doing a podcast on the wonderful, terrifying, anxiety-inducing game Dark Souls. And I'm just going to go around and let everybody introduce themselves.
This is Michael Hancock, Book Reviews Editor for First Person Scholar.
This is Jonathan Bolter, Assistant Professor of English at Western University.
Great, and we're also going to be joined with Rob Parker, who's a contributing editor for First Person Scholar, but he's lost right now and making his way to the room.
Very thematic for a Dark Souls podcast to have one of our members lost in a strange and labyrinthine building.
That's right. So the first question before we get into Dark Souls proper is how we came into the game with what sort of expectations. So there was a lot of talk and hype around this game, and if you're like me, you came into the game a little bit intimidated. You had heard about its immense difficulty, the challenges, the sort of psychological preparation you're going to need going into the game. So first I'd just like to talk about what we heard about the game beforehand and how maybe that affected our playthrough. So maybe we'll start with you, Michael.
Alright. I came into Dark Souls from actually having played the first one, Demon's Souls, and I'm going to say right now that I'm probably going to get the two mixed up at some point, so be ready for that. My introduction to Demon's Souls was someone playing it, and I was just handed the controller and being told, hey, go die now. And I think that really set the tone for my experience of the series, that this is what I was expecting to happen at all times and points.
Great. And Jonathan, what about you? Did you hear anything about the game first, or did you just sort of dive right in?
No, I also played the Demon's Souls obsessively, at least 15 to 20 times, and therefore I'd heard of Dark Souls coming onto the scene. So I didn't come into the game with any intimidation, generally. I came with great excitement, given my absolute love of the first game. And I was pleased to see there's a similarity of worlds, obviously, between games, but I was really struck by the seamlessness of Dark Souls, as opposed to Demon's Souls, where you had to sort of stop and get loading screens between worlds. I'm fascinated, still am fascinated by the absolute seamlessness of Dark Souls. Immediately seductive is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, definitely. So for me, I had heard quite a bit about Dark Souls before I played it. I think the game came out in 2011, and I had just picked it up, I guess about 6 months ago. Just around the time where I was just at the end of my dissertation waiting to defend. And I have to say, I was incredibly intimidated. And I think that's why I held off from playing it for a long time, is I'm not always the most patient guy, especially in video games. And I heard this game requires a lot of patience. And so I found that just to get myself psychologically prepared for this game took quite a bit. And so I definitely went into it with some anxiety. And after playing it, my anxiety was not misplaced. It was an incredibly frustrating game at times, as we know. And Rob Parker's joining us now. And Rob, we're asking, what did you hear about Dark Souls before you started playing it? And did that influence your perception of the game while you were playing it?
I'd actually heard about Demon's Souls prior to Dark Souls release. I was at the time kind of considering whether I wanted to get a console at some point in time, or a PS3. And so when Dark Souls did come out, and some of the stuff that I'd heard about it, on the one hand that it was a very difficult game, and then on the other hand that it was also kind of, it was shrouded in a certain level of mystique that I had not really seen in gaming since I started playing like in the mid-90s or something like that. And that, like, that coupled with the sort of simultaneous or almost simultaneous release of Skyrim, where Skyrim seemed very much the opposite of Dark Souls, to the point where even stuff that had been in like the Elder Scrolls series that had been very kind of hidden, so like the Thieves Guild and the Assassin's Guild, In like Daggerfall, for example, you didn't get contacted by them until you did stuff in the game that kind of triggered it, and you really didn't know what was happening, but it kind of responded to you. Whereas in Skyrim, you know, you had people that were, they would just come up to you and hand you a letter if you had not interacted with a certain type of content, or if you show up in Riften, it's like, welcome to Riften, home of the Thieves Guild. And it seemed kind of like they were stripping away some of that mystery, and I was interested to check out how Dark Souls kind of handled that stuff. And so when I saw a few live streaming playthroughs of it, it kind of tipped the scales and I wound up picking it up. As for how it impacted the way I played the game, it made me wonder if Dark Souls is actually a difficult game, or if it's just like it started making me ask what it means to say that a game is difficult. Because at a certain point, I felt like Dark Souls isn't constructed to be difficult, even though back of box, you know, it says prepare to die. But I feel like it almost has like a sense of responsibility or respect for your time that you kind of get out of it what you put into it.
The comparison to Skyrim's interesting. I read an article that Eurogamer put up a few days ago that was just raving about this new Skyrim DLC that has the Ebony Warrior in it, the toughest guy ever. And of course, there in the comment thread, it's like, a guy that takes you like 4 tries to beat? It took me more times to beat the Dark Knight in Dark Souls.
Yeah.
And that seems to be more than anything the sort of gamer culture about Dark Souls, that this is the hardcore experience, guys.
I was sort of interested in the fact that Skyrim and Dark Souls were released in the same year, within months of each other. And I played both and was struck by Skyrim and its relentless horizontal orientation, as a lot of RPGs tend to be. And what struck me about Dark Souls, and still strikes me today about Dark Souls, is its radical verticality. The fact that you're simply endlessly, seemingly endlessly descending into the depths of things. And that different spatial orientation, I've never come across before in an RPG necessarily, and it still strikes me as being a crucial component to the experience. This descending.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right, and I think spatiality is something we're definitely going to come back to, because Dark Souls doesn't seem like the type of game that would lend itself to being a platformer, and I think in many ways it is kind of an interesting take on platforming. So just maybe in most general terms, why is this game so compelling? It's a couple years old now, people are still just coming to it for the first time. There's still being things written on it. There's a whole book being written about Dark Souls right now, probably a couple actually. And so why? Why is the game so compelling, and why does it lend itself to so much analysis? And maybe Jonathan, we'll start with you.
Yeah, this is a question I've been thinking about a great deal. I'm actually writing about it as well in a book I'm preparing right now on posthumanism and space and gaming. And I think for me, a great deal of it has to do with a number of the game's relationships to contemporary philosophical issues. And I've been reading a great deal of games alongside Heidegger these days, and two components of Heidegger's thought strikes me as being resonant in this game. The first is, and this may be true of all games, is the way Dark Souls really thematizes coming to consciousness without any guidance. And one of the things I think we all notice about Dark Souls is the way in which it refuses, relentlessly refuses, to give you any guidance. And this strikes me as being fairly analogous to Heidegger's notion of thrownness, the sense that you're thrown into the world without guidance, without signposts, and you're asked or tasked, maybe is the better word, to find your way in the world. Dark Souls does this radically. And so at one level, it seems to be a thematization of that notion of Heidegger. I'm also interested in the way the game, and what compels me about the game, is my sense, and as I was saying before, I've played Dark Souls at a conservative estimate around 60 times. And I have this sense, even having played it that many times, that I have yet to discover everything about the game. And this sense that I was speaking about before, of the radical verticality of descending into the depths, I have a sense that I know intellectually that Ash Lake is the bottom of the game. But given the degree of hiddenness in this game, the degree of secrecy in the game, I always expect there to be more to it than I have found. And so my sort of short answer to what I think is compelling about the game at one level is the fact that I have a sense that I will never know the limits of this game. Heidegger speaks also about the fact that truth is hidden and wishes to remain hidden. And the way we encounter truth is via a kind of robbery. There's a violent wresting of the truth from its hiddenness. And I think this is also perfectly thematized in this game. You have to violently discover the truth of this game. But as I say, I don't think I'll ever have discovered the finality of this game. Tomb of the Giants, for instance, that area, which is pitch black as we all know, and despite the fact we can get various helmets or accoutrements to help us through the darkness, I still have no clear sense of the spatial geography of that area. I still have this sense that there may be areas that I have yet to discover, and that sense of endless secrecy is what really compels me in the game.
I think that's a great point. I think, Tomb of the Giants, the other part of that, of course, and I think for many stages in the game, is there's so much danger lurking in that darkness, and so you have to be very cautious. And it's one of the few RPGs where I've found sometimes I didn't want to explore. Sometimes I didn't want to know what was lurking in the darkness, what was behind the corner. A game like Skyrim, I tried to go over every possible square inch of the game, whereas as Dark Souls, there's just that constant anxiety that death and failure is lurking just around the corner. And of course, there's all those great GIFs going around the internet that just show the harsh brutality of the game where death just comes seemingly out of nowhere. And I think I agree with you, Jonathan. I think that the sense that you never feel like you quite know what's going on, you never feel like you've uncovered the whole story or everything in the game, and just that it at once draws in your desire to explore, but also in many ways punishes it. And exploration can often lead to failure. And I really like you bringing in Heidegger's concept of just sort of being thrown into the world. And we're going to come back to that in a second when we talk about walkthroughs, because although the game itself tells you essentially nothing, it's one of these games where you really have to pay attention to it. There's, of course, this whole online culture of the walkthrough and of the help forms. And so just to give our listeners some foreshadowing, we'll come back to that in just a second. And so Mike and Rob would like to hear why you guys think the game is so compelling, just in general terms.
Well, I think Jonathan really hit the nail on the head, that it's the way the game presents a sort of mystery to it. To compare to a game that is about as far different tonally as you can get, I was recently playing a visual novel called Monster Loves You, and it's a game that has a very it has its own sense of style, and it's very firm about that, but it's a game where essentially all you do is make choices, and the game is very clear: this choice bumps this stat is what allows you to make this choice later on, and it's all very, you can see everything behind the curtain all the time, and that sort of limits the playthrough. I know I can play it again and get a different ending, but I know exactly what I need to do to get that ending. And Dark Souls doesn't do that. It's got a mystery to it that I don't know what's going to happen after I complete this area. I don't know the direction I'm supposed to go next. And that can be very frustrating at times, but it can also be used as a way to urge the player on. A lot of the reviews of the new Call of Duty game say that it's basically doing what the game tells you to do. Oh, look at that explosion. The game's going to make damn sure you look at that explosion because they put a lot of money into it. Dark Souls, I never got the sense that, well, no, that's not quite true. Some of the bosses especially are very cinematic, but in general, there's a sense that the game doesn't care if you're going to be paying a lot of, if you're going to see the explosion or not. It's going to happen. It'll probably kill you.
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways, I almost feel like Dark Souls progresses in a sort of way that is not, like, the causality is not completely predicated on the player, or it's not clearly predicated on the player. So, I mean, we may wind up circling back to this, but like for the part that I found fascinating was, you see, like before I played the game, you hear a lot about how Dark Souls is kind of this very solitary, very brooding, very lonely game, but then you wind up running into all of these NPCs that are essentially going about, like, obviously the way that they handle all of that, like, the scripting is, you know, you go to a certain area and then an NPC changes. Or, like, you ring the bell and then suddenly you have Oswald downstairs after you ring the first bell and you beat the gargoyles. He's suddenly standing there and is willing to sell you some stuff. And so I felt like the idea that there were things happening that I was causing to happen or that were just happening without my input or in a way that I had no way of really appreciating, but that these characters kind of had motivations of their own. So, like, I'm playing through on the PC again, and every single time, because I have the ability to, every single time an NPC laughs, I'm taking a screenshot so I can have this entire collection of NPCs just, like, quietly chuckling themselves about a joke that I have no way of understanding, and I feel like that's very emblematic of why that game was so compelling to me. It was just, everyone I met had their own agenda. You know, you rescue Lautrec, and he winds up, you know, spoiler warning, he winds up killing the Firelink Guardian and taking her soul, and you have to go and hunt him down. Or you don't have to at all. It just, suddenly you come back later on in the game and you can't rest at that bonfire, which is a huge, that's the central hub for the game. And for me, that's that sort of sense of discovery where you're just encountering these things. And for me, I think that's what pushed me to discover, even though, you know, as Jason said, discovery is sometimes punished, or like exploring above and beyond your reach is sometimes punished, but at the same time, the game will give you its most interesting things if you do push those boundaries and start trying to go outside of your comfort zone.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I guess now that actually leads us into the next point, and that's what Jonathan was just sort of talking about indirectly. That's the idea of the walkthrough. And I'm wondering, did you all use walkthroughs? And what's the role of the walkthrough and I guess the online culture that sort of surrounds this game? And just to, and that might mitigate some of that thrown into the world, thrown in-ness from Heidegger. And I'll just say off the bat, I went into this resolve not to use a walkthrough. And much to my frustration and sadness throughout playing the game, I did cave once. I couldn't remember where I had to go to ring the second bell, so I went online and checked. But apart from that, I didn't, and I really felt like I never knew exactly what was going on or where I was supposed to go. I ended up going into areas I had no business being in. I didn't have the right equipment, didn't have the right weapons to fight off the enemies, and would die, and I had to realize after multiple failures, I'm not ready for this yet. And so I tried as much as I could to not rely on the walkthrough, but I have a feeling that that's a bit atypical, and most people did use walkthroughs, at least for the first time. And Jonathan, I was wondering, since you brought up Heidegger, what do you think the role of the walkthrough is in that sort of thrown-in-ness that Heidegger talks about?
Well, I think generally a walkthrough is there to mitigate, specifically in relationship to Dark Souls, its role is there to mitigate the anxiety, and this is a very anxiety-producing game. It's there to mitigate the anxiety of the forced or tasked discovery of the world. I refuse to use a walkthrough for this game, and I am aware of the online community, I'm aware of the online community's contribution to understanding the various lore, the lore of the game, but I, despite the fact that the game gives you no direction, or very little direction, until you've rung both bells, I found there's an uncanny logic to the way the world works, and it struck me immediately that I needed to go up rather than down. And it may have been in one of my early playthroughs, I made the mistake of attempting to go down through the skeletal area and just got toasted immediately. But after that, I realized I need to go up, and after ringing the first bell, it seemed logical to me that I needed to descend. And so what I'm saying is I found the game, despite its strangeness, despite its secrecy, it has a sort of uncanny logic to it that works in some sense against the lack of guides. And so I have yet to look at a walkthrough for this game. The only time later on, and maybe after my 10th play, when I realized I needed to find certain elements that will allow me to upgrade a shield, I would perhaps consult something that tells me where to find some demon titanate or whatever it is. But as for a walkthrough to guide me through the geography of the game, I never had to use one. I think it's also because I felt, and sort of instinctively, that the anxiety was a crucial component to the game play itself. And I didn't want to necessarily, and this might sound a little overly dramatic, but I didn't want to betray the logic and economy of the game by mitigating my anxiety with a walkthrough. But I think I might be atypical in this.
Are you guys cheaters? Do you guys use a walkthrough, unlike me and Jonathan, the purists?
Well, I'm glad you went with the term cheater there, because I am absolutely going to bust open a can of Mia Consalvo's Paratext and
beat me to it.
From Cheaters, her book on cheating there. I think the walkthrough, especially the wikis and so forth, are a perfect example of how a paratext of games function. To once again go into a game that doesn't seem very connected, way back in, and I might have some of this history wrong, 1984, Shigeru Miyamoto made Devil World, and that game was, at least according to his account years later, it was deliberately designed to be obtuse, that in order to get to some of the next levels, you had to walk into this wall a certain number of times and so, and he just put in these elements that no one would have gotten, but he put them in there because he wanted to encourage people talking to each other, to tell each other how to get past the parts. And I absolutely think that Dark Souls knows, or the designers of Dark Souls knows what they're doing in that regard. They're deliberately putting elements in the game that you have to talk to someone else to find out. I mean, there's a... And that creates a cultural capital, or gaming capital, as Consalvo would put it, that you put that those who are giving this information have a certain power, those who don't take any of the information at all, like you two, have a certain power as well, that you can say that you're the braved through it without anyone's help. And, I mean, things like the Drake Sword. You are probably not going to find that Drake Sword unless you consult a walkthrough. I mean, who's going to be like, oh, you have to shoot the dragon's tail? Obviously.
Yeah, I missed that.
And to kind of continue on from that, I would say, like Mike expressed a concern of, you know, what does it mean that Dark Souls is being held up as this paragon of hardcore gamer culture, which is, in my eyes, exceedingly problematic from just the way that that community tends to respond to people criticizing it. Like, I don't know if it's far off from assuming that at least a large part of people who, for example, are attacking Anita Sarkeesian probably consider themselves hardcore gamers and would see that almost as an assault on sort of their sense of worth within that identity of being a hardcore gamer. But on the other hand, you have, again, this game that is, you know, back of box quote, prepare to die. Like, that's central. Like, the marketing behind the game is absolutely trying to build it up as this hardcore experience. And so on the other hand, you also have, you know, you have the people that are producing the walkthroughs gaming that gaming capital, and then you also have people who refuse to use those walkthroughs also getting some sort of gaming capital, but then you also have people who just want to be able to say that they beat Dark Souls, and they don't necessarily talk about the fact that they went through a walkthrough, but they were able to, for example, find all of the items in the game. Or, you know, there's achievements attached to finding all the pyromancies, which are, you know, finding all the magic spells or upgrading a weapon to a certain level. And that's a different form of gaming capital, but it's certainly it is interlaced with the value of that, of getting like achievements in Dark Souls is higher than getting achievements in, say, you know, Sonic and Mario at the Winter Olympics. So I did absolutely go into a walkthrough, but mostly because I knew I didn't have a whole lot of time on my hands, and I wanted to explore as much of the world as possible rather than have to restart the game over it and try to get through it. Like, I will absolutely go and start the game and go back to it. I have, actually, in the process of preparing for this podcast. I've been playing through on PS3, and I'm about 80 hours into that, and now I'm about 20 hours into the PC version because I wanted to explore certain play styles that I didn't get to in the PS3.
Yeah, and I should say that I'm definitely not against walkthroughs per se. I use them all the time. I use them for Bethesda games like Skyrim and Fallout. I use them for the Zelda games, and I actually usually use walkthroughs quite extensively. But I just think there was something about this game, going into it and seeing the vibrant online culture and the helpful culture, I guess, people wanting to help other players. Even the Dark Souls subreddit, there's a lot of stuff still going on there, and people seem to be very helpful. And there's just something that made me want to consciously resist just doing a walkthrough in this particular game. I'm not sure if I'll do that again for Dark Souls 2. I said to Jonathan earlier, I probably put in 80 hours of this game before I beat it, and I feel like if I had a walkthrough, it would have went much, much quicker. And this idea of time that Rob just mentioned is a huge factor in this game, I think. This idea of, you know, what am I doing with my life, per se, but what am I doing with my time here? This is the, you know, 20th time I've faced the Capra Demon, and I'm still not getting anywhere close. Is this really worth my time? And so next time for the sequel, which I'm very much looking forward to, I might use a walkthrough. This time there's just something about it. It was almost a point of pride after a while, that I wanted to say that I did this without it. And so, I'm not actually proud of it now. It doesn't really mean anything. But just at the time, I just really wanted to try to do this sort of quote unquote on my own.
Getting your PhD isn't enough, Brian. Yeah. Writes like within weeks of that, he goes and plays Dark Souls.
Yeah. Very similar experience.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
Can I jump in on the time thing?
Yeah. Yes.
I came across the Slate review of this game by Michael Thompson just before we were put on this podcast, and he started out, "You can accomplish a lot in 100 hours." This isn't an exact quote. "You could read War and Peace, Thus Spoke Zarathustra, and start a course on a new language. You could watch Melancholia 40 times. You could drive from LA to New York. You could train for 20 weeks and run a marathon. Or you could play Dark Souls. You decide where your time is best spent." And there's this idea, especially with RPGs, and like Dark Souls and Skyrim, where we want them as big as possible. We measure their value in terms of how much time we spend on them, but then the argument goes, what are we spending our time on?
Mm-hmm. And Jonathan, you've played this game umpteen times. How much time would you reckon you put into it, and was it worth it in the end, do you think?
Yes, it's worth it, because it's the greatest game ever made. That's my first response. I can't tell you how many hours I put into it. It came out in 2011. I played most of the interesting AAA games in the interim, but I've been playing it constantly. And that would probably mean at least 4 days a week since it came out. I have two major sort of build characters. One is at a level 200 right now, and there I've invested, I think it's around 203 hours with that one character. A great deal, however, of the time that is put into creating my characters, however, is waiting for people to help me with Ornstein and Smog, or whatever his name is. A great deal of time waiting for help, because as you get into new game plus 3, 4, and 5, bosses strike me as being almost impossible solo. And so there's a great deal of time invested waiting for this game, but I do not see it at any level as a waste of time. There's something, and I'm still trying to figure out what it is about this game that I find compelling, but there's something refreshing about its implacable hostility. It's a tonic. And I'm also deeply attracted to the fact that it's not a waste of time in this economic metaphor we're using, because this is a game about work, as all RPGs are. It's about economics. It's about waste and expenditure. It's about, gathering economically currency in order to move on. And I understand non-gamers would look on this as perhaps in these terms of waste, but there is an accomplishment in the imaginative world, I think. And as a professor of literature, I believe this as well. I mean, I've read Beckett's Unnameable about 30 times, and there's no waste of time there as well. There's something to be gained in encountering this kind of hostile, imaginative world.
Yeah, I think that's really well put, and I agree. So actually, leading off that last point, the thing that I guess that struck me about Dark Souls compared to something like Skyrim or any of the Elder Scrolls, and really any RPG, is eventually in something like Skyrim, you're the most powerful thing in the game. And it actually, the challenge kind of goes away. Even the last boss in Skyrim, you defeat very, very easily at that point.
That's why you had an Ebony Warrior.
That's right, yeah. That's why you have DLC that adds one other dude. But Dark Souls, you are never the most powerful thing in the game, not even close. And even once you've beaten the game and you go back and you think, well, I have these wonderful items, I'm very powerful. Well, you start the game again, and actually now the enemies are much more powerful. And so it's almost like this reset, and you never, if you feel like you're climbing the hill, you never quite get there. You're always just sort of stuck in the middle. And I found that something to be very refreshing about Dark Souls, is you always feel vulnerable. You never get that sort of quote-unquote badass feeling that you might from a game like Elder Scrolls, like Oblivion or Skyrim. You're always constantly vulnerable. And I wonder if you guys had a similar experience and what the role of vulnerability and anxiety might play in this game.
Well, I'd say it's a little mitigated. I mean, if you start a game over again, you're going to transfer some of those skills over, and then the game starts getting a little badass when you take on those early bosses again and, like, I know how to roll now.
Yeah.
Yeah, but on the other hand,
how to backstab reliably.
Yeah. On the other hand, the game really does increase that sense of vulnerability. I mean, even if you're summoning other players, you're not summoning players that are weaker than you. You're summoning guys that are badass and can come in and take care of the business that you can't.
I've been trying to articulate how Dark Souls conceptualizes mastery, especially because it's such a central role to a lot of other video games coming out, where they're starting to complicate that a little bit, but for the most part, you know, there's that emphasis on feeling like a badass at the end of it, or that's sort of the progression of, that's how you mark your progression, by becoming more and more powerful. And even though you have more complex foes to deal with, you are so powerful that you can kind of brute force your way through. I feel like with Dark Souls, you can get that badass feeling. Go back to the Undead Burg if you ever have any problems. And just go back there and remember how difficult that was, and just, like, you are now laying waste to that area. But you also have armor on that, you know, can generally, like, you can just stand there and they can pummel you and it's not a big deal. But on the other hand, you're also not being rewarded very well for any of that. So you can do that just for your own benefit, but there's no game mechanics aside from, like, a putative amount of souls that really won't ever amount to anything. You have to clear out the Undead Burg several times to get past, you know, soul level 85 or 86. But I feel like that, and also understanding the stronger weapons in the game, how stats scale, and then also the animation priority. So, for example, like, Jonathan, you mentioned going towards the end of the graveyard at the start of the game and kind of just getting pummeled by the skeletons, which is funny, because skeletons are usually like an RPG fodder. They're usually what you're supposed to go and kill first. That said, in that graveyard, there are two of the most powerful items in the game. There's the Zweihander and there's the Winged Spear. The Winged Spear, once you get your dexterity up, the spears are generally, it's been referred to, like, using a shield and spear is like playing Dark Souls in easy mode, because you can always have your shield up and attack around the shield.
Switch up my weapons.
And then the Zweihander has a really long windup, but it scales exceptionally well, and if you upgrade it enough, it is just devastating. But you also have to understand the timing. So once you get a better sense of the animation priority, you innately have a better sense of mastery. Like, you've worked with a weapon for a long period of time, and you know it very intimately, and you also understand how to use it against other enemies that have, like, once you understand their animations. I think understand the game at that level, almost like a fighting game frame rate, like you're counting frames level, is really important. And I think that's where you're getting that distinct sense of mastery, where like that anxiety goes away once everything is kind of understandable, once you kind of know what an enemy is going to do, and know what you can do in response to them. That's where that sense of mastery comes in.
Although a lot of that, or at least if I was doing that, a lot of that would depend on how much I was using the walkthroughs and so forth, because I am not going to sit down and look up, oh, this weapon scales by this much.
Sure. It actually does show up in the stats, but the menus in Dark Souls are not super friendly.
Which, probably by design.
Yeah.
And Jonathan, what was your experience with vulnerability? And you are, I guess, sort of the, among us anyways, a Dark Souls master, having played it so much. Did you always retain that sense of anxiety and vulnerability?
Yes, I do. I don't think I would use comfortably the term mastery at any level in this game. I understand what you're saying about when you get the armor, you can go into certain sections and you can essentially be invulnerable. But that invulnerability comes at a cost, and that cost is absolute vigilance. You can't even in the undead burg be distracted, and I'm reminded every time I play of Freud and repetition compulsion as this desire to master some sort of initial event of trauma. The initial event of playing Dark Souls for me was traumatic in the low level sense of the term, and that trauma never really goes away. And despite the fact that I have a level 200 character, which seems absurd, I can still die quite easily. So I'm interested in the sort of demands that the game makes on you. Despite the fact that you're a master, you can still be killed quite easily. And that means that, and this is something I was thinking about this morning before talking to you folks, was this question of immersion. Whether or not Dark Souls is a game that actually invites immersion in the sense that you lose a sense of time and place as you're playing. I'm familiar with shooter games or any other sort of low-level RPG where you can really lose time quite easily because you lose a sense of what you're doing. I'm not sure that when I'm playing Dark Souls, I'm always aware that I'm playing. I'm always aware of the costs and the dangers, and that is related to this question of mastery, because I think when you're an absolute master in a game, you can simply you can afford to lose your attention. In this game, you cannot. And I'm fascinated by the demands the game places on you in that sense.
Yeah, and actually that brings me into our next point, and that's the spatiality in this game. And the way that I played the game anyways was mostly as a melee character. I had a big sword and thick armor. But at the same time, that really prohibits you from movement. And there's this really embodied sense about the game. You feel every swing, you feel every roll, especially if you're wearing heavy armor. I can't tell you how many seemingly simple jumps that I missed because I just didn't time my button press right.
Fight.
That's right, yeah, the Bed of Chaos fight, and in particular. And I think you're right, Jonathan. I think that it's, if there is immersion, it's a very odd type. And usually, immersion is thought of in the sense as you almost forget the body, and that's very problematic, obviously. That's sort of the general way that it's been thought about, is that you lose a sense of time and space and of physical embodiment. And I think Dark Souls does the exact opposite. And one of the ways it does that is it's through its platformer elements. The idea that you have to do a lot of jumping, you have to do a lot of timed maneuvers. And for me anyways, those are probably the most frustrating parts. Sen's Fortress in particular was just brutal. I died so many times just making a stupid little slip here and there. And again, I think that goes back to these ideas of immersion and embodiment. And so I wonder if we could just talk for a second about the intersection between this sort of embodied physicality you get with Dark Souls and the use of space, and in particular, verticality. And maybe, Jonathan, we'll start with you.
Well, one of the things I'm thinking about in terms of the game's orientation vertically, and forgive this reference to Freud again, but there's, and this is not really moving away from the embodiment question, we'll get back to that. I'm really interested in the way you descend into this game, and I'm fascinated by the way in which, as you come further and further into the game, down towards Ash Lake and descending through the Great Hollow, having had to go through two hidden doors to find the first bonfire, and then descending down to that treacherous tree to the very bottom, that descent demands an absolute sense of the body's relationship to space, especially descending along those tree branches. It's brutal. And encountering those, I think they're called basilisks, the ones that can curse you with this sort of purple fog they shoot out. That descent into Ash Lake was for me the most traumatic moment of the game. Finally making it to the bottom, finally exiting that space and looking and seeing that first bonfire on the bottom of the lake bed, which seems like 3 kilometers away in game space time, was still for me the most dramatic moment in the game. And it is, and this is going to be a bizarre admission, but Dark Souls is the only game that's ever infected my dreams. And having played it as much as I have, this is probably not unsurprising. But I had a very vivid dream of that discovery of that first bonfire as both a place of safety and a place of, again, implacable hostility. But again, that descent, it strikes me as something of, and I need to work this idea a little further, something like a descent into some sort of unconscious space. And I'm very interested in thinking through the dreamlike qualities of that game and the impossibility of immersion. I just cannot get fully immersed into a game, and yet it seems uncannily to invoke a kind of dreamlike space. And so there is some question here that we need to work through in terms of having always to be aware of one's body within this very sort of disembodied dreamlike space. That's the interesting question for me in this regard.
In terms of embodiment, I remember I've been basically cramming this game in the last few days. I have, unlike the other people here, I haven't actually completed it. I got as far as the second bell last night, and I was very happy with myself. But there was a point over the last few days where I was just like so frustrated because I kept asking myself, why is this game so slow? And eventually I realized, oh, I probably shouldn't be going everywhere wearing the Stone Giant armor. And yes, I've basically been turtling every moment of the game, just getting hit by everything, but grinning, just sort of grinning and bearing it. And then I switched to a leather armor, and my entire playstyle just transformed almost instantly. I was dodging and weaving, where before I was just standing still and dying whenever someone tried to do something that wasn't a physical attack. In terms of the verticality, I think it's one of the sort of common ways to analyze a game is to think of the actions it lets you do as sort of verbs, and I think it's interesting in a game that when you get down to it is a lot about platforming, moving up and down, that jumping is not an easy verb. This isn't something that you can do by just pressing one button. It's a technique that requires actual, like, learning. I won't tell you how many hours I was into the game before I learned you could jump. It's very embarrassing.
Wasn't that last night?
Shut up. And one more note on the spaces. I think one of the more interesting ways the game does mastery is the mastery of space. Just that, I mean, I was, again, very pleased with myself when in the depths I found the shortcut that meant I didn't have to deal with the basilisks anymore. And for all the game that we talk about how hostile the game is, it's very rewarding in the sense that, okay, you've done this, here's the shortcut to get back now.
Yeah, for me, I mean, that moment, that jaw-dropping moment, was figuring out that I could kick that ladder down after I got past the down to that first bonfire in the Undead Burg. And that was when I also had this mental image of like the game's maps and paths like curling in on itself like a fist, and that's the image that kind of stuck with me, is just like that it's very densely populated. And actually I found where the game didn't do that, I was very frustrated with it, like figuring out where I needed to go to get to the Duke's archives after a certain point, like I, because of the way I did the game, and maybe that was my, like, there's a different order to tackling certain areas, and if you do that, what's his face? Kingseeker Frampt doesn't show up. Actually, well, he does show up, but then he leaves, and you wind up dealing with a different primordial serpent, and I wound up doing that because I wanted to explore that path a bit. And as a result, there were two, like, vestigial areas that I didn't go to. So the last two areas I've gone through were the Duke's Archives and Lost Izalith and, like, the Bed of Chaos. So I'm basically up to the point where I need to go to the Kiln of the Eternal Flame or whatever. And those areas I felt were actually very frustrating because, especially Lost Izalith, where it's like, here's a gigantic open area with these jumping demons. I don't know, go for it. And it was just frustrating because you just had to put in time. Like there was no shortcuts to get through that or anything like that. You just had to keep going through it, which I was a little bit bummed out by that, but. How referential the game was in terms of its spatiality. So, like, being in the Tomb of Giants and looking over, and you can see the demon ruins below. And, those vertical environments. I think, Jonathan, you're on a pretty good path there. Like, both that tree down to Ash Lake and also the descent into the Crystal Caves were two of the most, traumatic experiences in the game for me. And then in terms of, like, the animation and embodiment stuff, the animations are phenomenal as far as if you've equipped a halberd or a greatsword and you swing and you miss something, your character is jerked off balance by the weight of this sword. And that's a feature that is fundamental to those weapon classes, whereas some other like lighter weapons you're not jerked off balance, but you can see them stagger, and it adds a great heft to it. And I think also the way that the controls are laid out on the controller are also very... very emblematic to, you have the left shoulder buttons for the left arm and the right shoulder buttons for the right arm. They map very well. But yeah, you're right. Like, I was never able to fully engage myself, even when I was just bashing my head against a boss for, like, the 15th or 16th time, where everything was mostly muscle memory at that point, and I was still messing up. Mm-hmm. So.
That's great. And so, just to go back to these sort of maybe jaw-dropping moments, there's some times of absolute beauty in this game, I think. Visual beauty, even some of the music is beautiful in its own creepy way. Mm-hmm. And I want to talk a little bit about, maybe we'll conflate these, about one, the narrative, and two, the aesthetics and the atmosphere, because I think they go very, very well together. A lot of times in Dark Souls, of course, you don't see the sun. You are either underground or just in some gloomy lit area, and then you have these moments where you get these magnificent panoramic views that are just really stunning, and it's very refreshing. And it kind of reminds me of that moment in Fallout 3 when you emerge from the vault and you see the wasteland for the first time, and it's just sort of awe-inspiring in a way. And so I wonder if we could just talk about the game's aesthetics and its narrative. Does it have a coherent narrative? Does it have a coherent aesthetic vision, or is it many, many things at once? And just personally, I didn't feel like I comfortably knew what the narrative was for most of the game, essentially till the very end, and so near the end, and you sort of start to piece it together. But certainly, up until I rang the second bell, I was never quite sure what I was supposed to do or why I was doing it. You just get a little bit of an introduction at the beginning. And then again, unlike something like Skyrim, it's never sort of pounded into your head why it is that you're doing it. And it's not until a bit later that it becomes a little clearer. So I wonder, Jonathan, if you could talk a little bit about aesthetics and narrative, either as separate things or maybe as one thing.
Well, the first response I have to the question of the narrative of the game is to, and again, as someone who's played it 60 times, is to actually wonder if there is a narrative. I have played it that many times, and I still don't know quite what's going on. I don't know, and this is my own probably willful ignorance, what precisely my task is beyond survival. I know there's something about linking bonfires, there's something about fire and life, but it struck me that the narratives that are important in the game are the narratives I tell myself after I stop playing, like, can you believe it took me 10 hours to beat this specific boss? It was, do you remember what it was like when that person came in and invaded you or helped you with a boss? I'm not convinced that the narrative proper in the game, for me, in my experience, is as important as the narrative of movement through the various spaces. The narrative, for instance, of beginning at the bottom of Sen's fortress, making your way through that area, which is basically a trap area, until you emerge after the defeat of the boss into Anor'Londo, which truly is a sort of rising up towards a... It's a kind of birth moment, not unlike the emergence into the wasteland in Fallout 3, which is explicitly a kind of birth into a new space. The moment of encountering Anor'Londo and the great vista and the great architecture, which is probably based on certain Italian architecture, is a remarkable moment for me. It still is a remarkable moment. But again, my sense of the narrative of the game is that it is not as important. And in fact, I would maybe suggest that the game sort of disavows an explicit narrative in favor of the narrative that has evolved off-site, online, the kind of narratives that are told about the story and the various pieces of the lore that people have found. I have no idea how they know this stuff. I've talked to all the NPCs in the game, and I still don't know. The first undead merchant, if you kill him, he says something about Yulia. I assumed Yulia was maybe his daughter for some reason. I think I read somewhere last night that maybe it refers to the sword that you take from him. I don't know. There's no way of knowing these things for me. So as I'm saying, I think the game works towards a very interesting disavowal of an explicit narrative in favor of an occult, i.e. hidden narrative, that relates in some senses to the discovery of various spaces. But that's my take on things.
I think you're absolutely right. The key here is the narratives that have been generated out of the game. I mean, I've read Matt Sakey did a player's diary of the game that just, where he kept track of every single time he died in the game. And this is a player's diary that has at least 14 parts to it. I mean, it was one of my first experiences with the game, and it was, I felt like I had been through some sort of epic struggle just from reading the account. I mean, you read anything that's 14 parts and it'll feel kind of epic when you're done. But I didn't have much experience with the narrative. I found it very hard to relate to any more than a handful of NPCs, just because, especially the ones that moved around, because there would be dozens of hours between one time I saw them and the next. I'd forget who they are, which is one of the things I relied on from the walkthroughs. Just, okay, who is this guy again? I don't know these characters' names. Thank you for telling me online, internet. And as for the aesthetic, what really strikes me is the, even more than the locations, are the monsters. I mean, every monster gets their own little cinematic introduction, and some of those are pretty impressive. I mean, my favorite is the Gap Dragon, where this little medium-sized, still bigger than you, little thing comes out, and then it's just like a anglerfish's lure to this giant, massive creature. And I was like, really? You're really going to make me do that?
Yeah, this Vagina Dentata in dragon form just kind of comes out.
I'd be very surprised if it was the only example of that in the game.
No, I mean, if you look at the Sybil for Humanity, Anyways.
Although I do want to come back to monsters at a later.
Sure. I actually did go... I spent a lot of time actually trying to piece together some of the narrative elements of the game. And what I found was actually, A, it's extremely, if you really think about a lot of the bosses, especially like Seath the Scaleless, there's a certain level of melancholy that I mean, it is evoked in the music, it's evoked in the sort of the design. I mean, the first person you encounter is the crestfallen hero or crestfallen warrior, and he's the one that gives you the only level of direction in the game until you see King Seeker Friend. And I think, you know, having that visual aesthetic and having a very drastic difference between areas is really important, especially because you spend so much time in them. And you is that going up into Anne Orlando and suddenly it's like sunny skies and you are actually walking around, or like being cooped up in the Duke's archives, and that just that short run down into the Crystal Caves, there's this moment where you're in this idyllic kind of forest and you're again exposed to like the open sky. I'm on board with the rest of you guys that, you know, the most important narrative is really the your interaction with other people. So, you know, I was invaded once and someone tricked me into attacking Solaire. And this was very early in the game, and Solaire is one of the few NPCs who's actually friendly to you. And it's really fascinating if you go online and look at the Dark Souls community and see which NPCs they have an affection for. Because really, a lot of the NPCs are inscrutable, and they just kind of chuckle to themselves like assholes every single time you talk to them, except for like Andre or Solaire. I mean, for the most part, those are the only two friendly characters, and the giant and Orlando.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of them are always so inscrutable and hard to get a handle on. But if you look up any images of Solaire, there's just like tons and tons of fan art of him just like jolly cooperation, and he's almost made as this almost like a clown, essentially. I mean, it doesn't help that he's dressed like one of the Knights of the Round Table from Monty Python. But
is it Lardak that kills the Keeper of the Flames?
Lautrec, yeah.
Yeah, I felt, yeah, that I just got to that point, and I felt personally aggrieved because he was my buddy. He was the guy that I would never have gotten past
the
gaping dragon or the gargoyles without him.
And yeah, unfortunately we're down to about our last 10 minutes. I feel like we could talk about this game for hours and hours. Maybe we'll do a part two. But let's just talk, I guess, about the NPCs briefly. And we've already started talking about them and how they might add to the sense of unknowing. So as Rob said, they always seem to be chuckling to themselves about some joke that you're not in on, and that you might be the butt of the joke. And the butt of the joke, at least seemed to me, was, oh, look at you, you think you're going to be different. So many have tried before, I've tried before. Here you are, I can't tell you not to go, just go on and fail for yourself. And on the other hand, whenever I came across an NPC, I felt comfortable and safe. But I didn't feel alone. And the game, for most of the game, you feel like you're very much in it alone. So even these NPCs who are creepy and chuckling themselves, they almost give you an element of respite from the hostile loneliness of the world. So maybe we could talk about, just briefly, NPCs, maybe a favorite interaction with an NPC, and just what you think that they bring to the game as a whole. Maybe, Jonathan, we'll start with you again.
Well, one of the experiences I have with the NPCs is, and I can't quite think if there's any other game that does this, the way they move from area to area. And it strikes me still that, and I realize fully intellectually I'm wrong about this, but in terms of the imaginative world that we're in, these NPCs seem to have a kind of agency that I've never seen in other NPCs. They had a kind of will, and they had a sort of fully fleshed world they carried with them. And so the first time you meet Lautrec, I think he's in a cage. You save him. You meet him again at the below the bonfire, and then you can meet him again if he kills your keeper. There's a real sense that he's got a narrative that he's playing out that's sort of independent of your own. That the game doesn't really care necessarily about your interactions with them. I just find, and I know I've been using this word too often today, but There is a real uncanny quality to these NPCs, as opposed to any other game I've played with NPCs, that they really do seem to have a kind of strange agency. And I think part of the reason that they, part of the, my way of interacting with them, given this agency, is I tend to avoid them. I tend not to speak to them. If I have to speak to them, I click through the dialogue tree as quickly as possible. I find them almost to a person, creepy. Solaire, I find predatory in a curious sort of way. I find, well, Lautrec obviously is hostile. Certain NPCs are clearly not hostile. Big Hat Logan is kind of a strange parody of a professor, I suppose. But I tend to avoid them because I find them, in a strange way, disquieting.
My experience of the game has been different from a lot of people in that I can't get the online portion to work on my computer. So it's the only help I've had on any of the boss fights are the ones you can summon NPCs for. And you develop a real affection for them based on that. I mean, I probably would not have gotten past gotten the second bell rung if it hadn't been for the mad woman I summoned shortly after having to kill her. And the giant butterfly creature was entirely the NPC's fight for me. I just kind of huddled back and let her do her thing.
I really thought I also had the similar response to the NPCs that you did, Jonathan. I found them very unsettling, and that's why I wanted to keep engaging with them. And in a lot of cases, and I guess that's also a larger question, you know, when we're talking with Dark Souls, like how much of these are issues of translation versus intent. Apparently, like, they traverse the white fog or something like that means, like, in the original game, it actually more accurately translated to just, like, walk through this fog gate. And it just happened to be it was translated in a very different way. I think the 8-4 podcast talked about that a while ago, and they do localization. But yeah, I found interacting with them unsettling, but it was something that I indulged in because I really enjoyed it. I thought it was very strange, and it was almost Lynchian in terms of how dreamlike, and these people I almost got the feeling that a lot of the NPCs were not directly addressing me as much as they were talking to themselves or addressing a ghost or something. Which, I mean, given the ghostly nature of a lot of the game, it seems kind of like it would make sense. Like, I don't know how I appear to them, obviously. I would say probably my favorite exchange is, it's effectively a murder mystery, the monk or the... He was protecting the young girl when they went into the Tomb of Giants. And he winds up back out there, and he's the first guy you encounter, and he sells you miracles. And if you rescue the young woman who's being taken into the catacombs, she winds up back in the undead parish. And then at a certain point, she's murdered, and it's heavily implied that this monk was the one that killed her. And like some of the dialogue options have been kind of cut apart by people who have been very closely reading the game, and I find that stuff very fascinating to kind of engage with. I've tried to follow through all of the storylines that I could, and some of them I missed one facet of it, and they just disappeared. Which I think added to the mystery of the game, that sometimes these NPCs will just vanish forever. Sigmire, the guy that was wearing the onion suit of armor, I got into the demon ruins and he didn't show up for me, so his story just kind of ended at some point, which is unfortunate because I thought he was a very funny guy.
Actually, when you mentioned murder mystery, it reminded me that one of my favorite NPC interactions came from the first game, Demon's Souls, where there's another guy in a cage, and if you free him, he goes to the main hub of the game, and eventually he starts straight up killing the other NPCs. And if you let him, if you don't catch on that he's doing this, he will eventually kill them all. And that's amazing for that game, because your hub is very much like this safe spot where nothing else ever hurts you. Except for this one NPC that can go around killing the other NPCs.
Is he the one that shows up later on in Dark Souls? Like, there's one NPC that shows up in Dark Souls. You meet him in the Tomb of the Giants, and he kicks you off that ledge.
No, that's a different guy.
Okay.
He does get the Jackal?
I think it's the Jackal. And I think that's really
fascinating. He's also treacherous in that.
Yeah, is looking at, you know, where does Demon's Souls figure in terms of Dark Souls? Like, there's clearly some carryover. Some of the lore seems to kind of coincide a bit.
It's very much a Final Fantasy thing. We're going to keep the Moogle.
Okay, all right.
Or, no, I that's just my view.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I like that they did that, that there are a few characters that are possibly friendly, but you're still not quite sure about it. Like, they still laugh at random points, and you're not quite sure how to handle that stuff. I find it adds to the atmosphere of the game when I'm not getting invaded by other people.
Yeah, I want to talk about the online and the invasions in just a second, but just, and maybe Jonathan, you had a similar experience. Because I didn't use a walkthrough, I ended up killing some NPCs by accident that I really wish I wouldn't have, and I either lost out on some story or even some items that might have helped me. And I think that goes back to this idea of being just sort of thrown into the game without being told anything, is it gives you all this freedom. But what I ended up doing with my freedom a lot of the time was hurting myself. I didn't have that strict here, now you go here. Here's someone who's friendly, here's someone who's not. It was not always clear who was friendly and who wasn't. And I'm thinking, down when you go to the Daughter of Chaos, to that fire, that bonfire, and there's one of the guys with who's encased in like a worm, I guess, or something.
Mm-hmm.
And up to that point, they had all been hostile, and they were quite powerful and quite a pain to kill. And so I just saw him, and I started firing arrows at him. And as soon as I hit him, he laments, and he says something like, "Oh, I knew that he was like all the rest, and I killed him." And it sort of, I felt guilty in an odd way that I'd done this, and I'd been so careless. And there was a couple moments where I think Shiva, the cat, I killed as well, and because I answered incorrectly to one of her questions, and then couldn't get anywhere else with her, and so what else am I going to do but kill her, I guess. And so that was this moment where, because I didn't know, I ended up losing out on the game. And so it really invites a second playthrough so that you can experience those moments. And so maybe just to, not least, I'm thinking about the forest now. And the online element. Now, my first encounter with the online element was right by a cliff. Some joker had written, "Try jumping." And being the naive fool I was, I tried jumping and fell to my death. And there's this odd... So again, you never know quite who to trust. You don't know which NPCs to trust. You never know which messages to trust. Because other times, messages were very, very helpful. And so I want to talk just briefly about what do you think the online element plays in the game. I resisted it as much as I could for a while, and then once you get to the later bosses, you essentially need help from other people. So Jonathan, maybe we'll start with you again. What did you think the online element added to the game? And would the game be as compelling without it, or does it matter that much?
But the first time I played through the game, I didn't use the online element at all. In fact, I think I played it offline and beat it, and I still don't know how I beat Ornstein and his obese friend, because that is a brutal fight if you're playing simply by yourself. But I did manage to play the whole thing through without any invasions, without summoning anyone. And then I started playing in a more complicated way and realizing that you're missing out on this uncanny experience. And I really do think summoning people or being summoned and then being unable really to communicate with these people beyond the limited sort of gestures of bowing and praising the sun or whatever it is you're doing, there's a real sense still of, yes, you're together, but there's an absolute and radical isolation as well, because there's no possibility of any real communication. You can, in the PS3, you can get out and get into the menu and talk, but it's very clunky and very complicated. It's a game that really does not wish you to have any profound connection with other people. But there's no way in hell I can play the game at new game 6 without the online component and the online community. I use them all the time. I don't think beyond my first playthrough I've ever been able to beat Nito without summoning someone. But the brutality of that boss is there, it seems no one ever is there at that second bonfire. I've ended up waiting hours. Last time I played a couple of days ago, I waited about 3 hours for someone to show up. And then he didn't know what he was doing, and so it was a useless expenditure of time. But you absolutely need these people to play now at New Game Plus 6 or 7 that I'm doing.
Yeah, I find it interesting that Jason, you use the... You summon other players too? Or?
Yeah, at the end I have
Yeah, see, I find it interesting there that... On the one hand, both of you say that you don't like using the walkthroughs, but it's okay to get someone else to fight with you?
Well, it's in the game,
yeah.
So it's you're not going outside the game, so that's why I'm just not a hypocrite.
Well, I don't...
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so I tell myself.
Yeah.
Well, I'd argue that the game's asking you to go consult the walkthroughs too, but that's we've already hashed that part out. In terms of my own online play, I haven't been able to get it working for Dark Souls, but for Demon Souls, it absolutely added just so much to the game to just have these specters playing around me at all times. It felt basically like I was alone, but not alone. And especially in Demon Souls, there's one boss that is essentially an invading player, and I would deliberately go offline just so I didn't have to fight someone who knew what they were doing.
Yeah.
And one time I forgot, didn't realize it until I got into the room, the mist, like right before. I was like, I'll just wait this guy out. And when he didn't leave after about 20 minutes, I went in and he instantly killed me because, you know, I made him wait 20 minutes. But then he sent me a message saying, sorry, I backstabbed you, but come on, 20 minutes? And it was like, I don't play a lot of online gaming, and that was just a moment where, oh yeah, these are real people.
Yeah.
I'm wasting other people's time.
You deserved it. Yeah.
Yes. Oh yeah, I said as much.
Yeah,
I relied very heavily on a walkthrough through certain points of the game, but I didn't necessarily, because of the complexities, really not all of that information is completely surfaced. So when I was maybe 5 or 10 hours in, I had just beaten the Hellkite Drake, the dragon on the bridge, and was in that bonfire underneath the dragon, and I was invaded. And it was probably the first time I'd actually been properly invaded in the game. And I said, all right, well, let's try this out. And so they were the invading specter came down the bridge, and we actually, because I'd been using my pyromancy or whatever, I was doing pretty well in the fight somehow. So they basically ran all the way back to Solaire and managed to get around behind him. And I was so consumed with bloodlust to just get this person out of my game because I was panicking because I didn't know what I was doing for the most part. I flung some fire at Solaire and he immediately went aggro, and then I had to sprint all the way back down the bridge, and eventually the player just caught up to me and I'd given up and I just let them kill me. And I did not realize that you could purchase, like, I would shortly thereafter be able to purchase forgiveness from NPCs, and so I didn't want to leave Solaire around aggro just in case he would just show up randomly elsewhere and then kill me. So I went back and murdered the only semi-friendly NPC I'd encountered at that point, and I went online and started talking to people, and I committed a crime, basically. And so I actually, in penance, I wore Solaire's armor for the remainder of the game. Or at least until a certain point where I killed Lautrec and I got his armor and then started wearing that because I felt like that was more closely aligned with the sins I'd committed.
Has anyone here done a lot of invading?
Not much.
I was a Gravelord servant for a while, which is one of the covenants. And what you can do with that is actually infect other people's worlds. And when you do that, I think it's either spawns a more difficult monster or it makes monsters more difficult within their worlds. And somewhere within their worlds, there's a sign that they can touch and that will have them invade your world. So you can hypothetically get invaded by two or three other NPC or other players from worlds that you've infected, and then also just get invaded properly by regular invaders. And that seemed like a really interesting thing. Of course, I was not very good at fighting PvP, so I died very frequently. And actually, Jonathan, I wanted to say that with the DLC, they added the option, I wasn't sure if you were aware of it, but they added the option that you can recover certain items that if you throw them on the ground, they will say a certain phrase, like very good, but it's this weird digitally generated or modified soundbite. So it sounds very muffled, like it's coming from a great distance. And you have to keep that in the, like, you'd have to select that as though you would your Estus flasks. So if you do want to communicate with people in an online setting, you throw this wood on the ground and it says very good, or like thank you, or I'm very sorry. And it's very fascinating to see that they added some limited voice communication.
And Jonathan, did you, I mean, you sound like a nice guy, or did you go in invading other players and taking their souls?
Well, in my 2 years of playing, I think I've invaded twice just out of boredom. I have this very strange response when I'm gaming. I never kill NPCs if I can help it. I feel guilty if an NPC gets killed, like the Bonfire Keeper when she was killed by Lautrec. I felt horrendous for a couple of days. I never invade. If someone invades, I would say 80% of the time I just quit the game and leave because I don't have time. I don't want to play PvP. I'm terrible at it. I just think it's a strange distraction from the real game. But no, I never invade.
Yeah, I was sort of the same way. And so we get to the last question, and it feels like we haven't even scratched the surface. Some really interesting stuff I think you brought up, Jonathan, with guilt, with the dreamlike quality of the game. So perhaps we'll do a part two in the future. So the last question we'll end with is the game's ending. And I know not everyone here has beaten the game, and obvious spoiler alerts. There's essentially two endings that you can get. And you can either, after feeding the Lord of Cinders, you can either light the bonfire and usher in the heir of humanity, or so you may think, or you can choose not to and keep things as is, and you're sort of seen as the Lord, and all the serpents sort of bow to you and seem to pledge allegiance to you. Now again, because I didn't know any better, I was stuck with this choice whether to light the last bonfire or not, and I decided, well, why don't I just go do some last minute exploring. So I'll walk out of this room and we'll see what happens. Well, as soon as I walked out of the room, the game ended, and I got the game's ending, and I didn't mean to do that. And so I was sort of the inadvertent Dark Lord, I like to think of myself as. I probably would have lit the fire. That's sort of what you're told to do the whole time, but I didn't. And if for those who haven't finished the game, or maybe you finished it and don't understand, there's some amazing just videos on YouTube and stuff written on interpretations of the game. And Jonathan, I'd like to hear you've beaten the game a few times. What's your thoughts on the ending? Is it too ambiguous? Did you get any sort of meaning from it? Or maybe did it not matter?
Well, I teach modern literature, and so I'm attracted almost congenitally to ambiguous narrative. My comments on the narrative of this game indicate that I don't think narrative really matters. And so I've played both endings many times, and it has no effect or impact on me at all. And it has no effect and impact on me at all because as soon as the very brief cutscenes end, you're into a new game almost automatically. And there's no resonance, there's no carryover from the game's ending into the new game. I would be very interested to see what would happen if I could play New Game 1 as the new Dark Lord. That's an entirely different game, obviously. But it does strike me that the seamlessness between game and then New Game 1 effaces any resonance of the ending entirely. So my response is I don't really pay attention to the ending, and if I did, it wouldn't matter because the seamlessness of the playing effaces the importance of the ending. It strikes me. So I don't really see any sort of necessary complicated politics at work because it seems, again, as if the narrative is utterly disavowed by the gameplay.
I have not finished the game, but I've watched enough. I know enough about the ending. I get hitched up in the DLC, so I haven't had a chance to really take it to Gwyn yet. For me, though, where I find it interesting is I don't necessarily, like, I'm not sure if maintaining the status quo is the good ending. Like, lighting that bonfire, like, I was not convinced by that. And also, what I find more interesting is, yes, for the most part, the narrative doesn't necessarily matter, but getting a sense of direction. Like, at a certain point, King Seeker Frant shows up in the Firelink Shrine and seems like he's generally kind of on your side. And so he kind of starts giving you direction, but he's, as with any of the NPCs, he's not very trustworthy. And the way that I played through, Kingseeker Frant actually left because of the way that I played through it, I wound up, instead of Kingseeker Friend, I wound up with Darkstalker Kath, who is the... You have to go to the Abyss to hang out with him. And that's how you join the Darkstalker faction, and that's very much the PvP version of the faction. But they give you some interesting items that can suck humanity out of NPCs and stuff like that. And at the end of the dark, for the dark ending, I think it's Darkstalker Kath who addresses you when you walk away from the fire. And I think not necessarily. I like the fact that the ending is very ambiguous and there's not necessarily a great sense of right and wrong. But I like the resonance that leads up to that in terms of you're not given a lot of guidance in this game, so you tend to rely on anyone who's kind of telling you a way to go forward, but none of them are super trustworthy, and I like that they have this sort of weird, almost like shifting sense of loyalty and this sort of ambiguous response to like what it means for darkness and lighting these bonfires.
Great. Well, we're gonna have to end it there, unfortunately. And I want to thank you all so much, Jonathan, for joining us via Skype, Mike and Rob for being here. Thanks so much, and I really enjoyed our conversation today. That's it for this FPS podcast. Thanks for joining us. Stay tuned for next time.